Welcome to the second of a four-part series on King Records' Cincinnati Legacy. I'm Lee Hay. During this hour, you'll hear the first half of a roundtable discussion about King Records, moderated by music journalist Larry Nager. This week's discussion will focus on the contributions of Otis Williams and session drummer Philip Paul to the King legacy. You'll hear music by a number of King artists, including Otis Williams and the Charms, Tiny Bradshaw, Freddie King, and Boyd Bennett and the Rockets. Let's begin with King Records, Cincinnati Legacy, Part 2.
Hi, I'm Larry Nager. I'm a longtime Cincinnati music journalist, and I'm sitting today with some of the founders of the reason Cincinnati can call itself a music capital, and of course that's King Records, which lasted from 1943 through 1968 and created some of the most memorable recordings of all time. Funk was invented here in Cincinnati, Mr. James Brown, on Brewster Avenue in Evanston at King Records. And, of course, King was a founder of Jump Blues, which was pretty much the stepdad of rock and roll, just about a year or two divided from that. But no matter what kind of music you like, King recorded some of it, and some of the best, you know, whether it was Fever by Little Willie John, whether it was The Twist by Hank Ballard, whether it was Freddie King and Hideaway, whether it was some of those great Otis Williams hits we'll be talking about. And we have some very exciting guests here today. It's we're going to kind of hold a King Records seance. And we've got Otis Williams and... We've got Philip Paul. Now, Otis, were you there before Phil, or did Phil get there first?
I really don't know. I think we were about the same time. You might have been a little earlier than me.
Yeah, well, I'm Philip Paul. I started King Records in 1952.
Yeah, we started the same time.
Yeah, I came down here from New York to join Tiny Bradshaw.
Right.
And he was on the contract to King at that time.
Right.
So
naturally,
I started recording with him then.
So and so 1952 is when you first recorded with Tiny Bradshaw there?
Yeah, that's right.
We started around the same time then.
And how did you come to King, Otis Williams?
Through a variety show at Withrow High School. We were on the show and someone heard us. A representative of King Records actually called my mother. It was early in my sophomore year of high school, so it had to be 52. Asked me if I wanted to record. Well, they asked me to come over and talk to him about it, and I said, well, okay, I'll come over and talk. So my mother and I went over. He said he wanted to try to do something with us. And I said, well, I'm not interested in doing any recording. I was playing football, you know, and I was going on to college, and I had a Cincinnati Reds baseball contract. So I had it all going at one time, you know, and I really didn't have any, I wasn't a singer, you know. So I told him, no, I don't want to do it. So he talked to me and talked to my mother, and he... wine and dine us for a couple of days and talked me into signing a contract with him. He didn't want to sign the group. And I said, well, without the group, I'm not going. You know, I'm not going to record.
So was it a doo-wop group? Or you did, what, who were your
we
sort
didn't,
of inspirations?
It was not, there was no such thing as doo-wop,
doo-wop
then.
Mm-hmm. So it was more like an Ink Spots kind of thing? Or so you did and, your original material while you did recording? Or?
No, everybody sang blues. It was blues and jazz. That's mm-hmm. all we had in those days. It was blues and jazz. It wasn't even R&B then. Do you remember being R&B? It was no R&B,
yeah.
Right? It was just blues and jazz. We danced to it and we sang it. It was a different time, and it was just early on in the beginning of all this. You know, King was like the forefront. They had the forefront of this whole music industry. And he was just throwing guys in there, throwing tunes at them, and trying to do what he could do. You know, we worked with big bands, Tiny Bradshaw's band, Buddy Johnson's band. You know, I even worked with Billy May's band.
Oh, okay.
You know.
How'd they convince you to finally come to King?
Well, I guess my mother said yes. Mm-hmm. You know, I really was against it. Then mm-hmm. the guys wanted to record. I really couldn't sing. And naturally, at that age, you know, you're a little fearful. But we did a lot of stuff around, you know, the schools. It was a little diversion from playing football and baseball, you know. So it was something, then all the girls liked it, you know. So that made a big difference.
And you had the records, too. That must have been
well,
something.
Then we didn't have anything, you know. We recorded for a year and a half without a hit. I wrote most of that stuff.
Are you pleased so you can hear my teardrops falling?
Calling.
it, please. The beating of my heart pounds, pounds, pounds when my love is not around. I hear voices in the night shouting, it's not right for you to leave for me. Why are you pleased? I'm trying.
Just threw it out there, and this Sid was pretty good at that. Very good innovator. He started this stuff, and he'd pick stuff out, and he wouldn't like this stuff, anything we would like. 9 out of 10, Sid didn't like it. But he was country-orientated, and he hated James, didn't like Willie John. He didn't like Willie because Willie didn't, adhere to anything he said. Willie was just a little wild child. You remember that, Paul?
Yeah.
Willie just did whatever he wanted to do, and Sid just turned his head. He couldn't do anything with Willie. He didn't like James's music. Well, James wasn't there then.
Yeah, James came in 56.
Yeah, he didn't get his hit to 56. Ray Charles, James Brown, and Little Richard, they all hit the same year, 56. Yeah. So we're two years earlier than them, but we used them as backup bands. James was my backup band, I guess, for maybe a year. You know, we used Hal Smith. The bands of the day, and you use a shake dancer and an MC and the group, and that's what you had.
So it's kind of almost like a vaudeville show you had.
It was all new. We didn't know what we were doing. You know, we had nothing to go by.
The great thing about that, I mean, when you're telling that story, and it's such a totally different age, the idea that a kid in a high school talent contest gets a record label courting him in his hometown. I mean,
right.
for Cincinnati kids, I mean, what a great thing. You know, right. What an opportunity, and what an idea that, you know, yes, you can do something, and it's not some kind of dream of going to Hollywood or some kind of, you know, far-off land or something. It happens right in your hometown, right in your high school. I mean, that is such a hopeful thing for the other kids who would see you doing that. I mean, that's how you create a music scene, it seems like, is when someone succeeds. When you got a James Brown coming to town in limousines, everybody wants their own limousine.
Right,
you know,
didn't have anything. I mean, there was very little there. We couldn't get played on white stations. So that was the damper on our music career starting out.
Yeah, it wasn't until 54 that the Color Lines even started a little bit, and then it wasn't very much, for that matter.
It came up with Hearts Made of Stone, pretty much started it.
So you got so big that they had to play you at that point. Is that the
No, what happened, we watched this song for like 6 months, 5 months, something like that, and nothing happened with it by this other group out in California. And Sid, like I said, he's always pulling stuff out of the woodwork. And he thought I could sing anything, and I couldn't sing a lick. He'd give me something by Nat Cole to do, anything, you know what I mean? He was just searching. And he happened to pull a good one out. That was Hearts Made of Stone, which I hated. and he asked me to go ahead and rearrange it from the original. So I did that, and the group and I. It hit the charts, I think something like 20 or something like that, which surprised everybody. We went on the road with it to my last year of high school. We got out of school in June, and so in August, we were on the road. We had an agent out of New York, Shaw. We did TV shows. We did work Bob Brown when he first, his stint at doing his own show. We did the pilot for him. We did Soupy Sales out of Detroit. Just mostly doing record hops, which we never got paid for. They play your record for 2 weeks and before you came in, and then after, or maybe 2 or 3 days afterwards, but then that's all. But Hearts Made of Stone took off so good, so when it hit the hit parade, the Fontaine Sisters jumped on it. And that was the beginning of the crossover, because it was the hit parade was all pop. With this Hearts Made of Stone thing, when it hit, well, that crossed over. The white artist was doing black artist music.
Hearts made of stone.
Finally, we got played because the Fontaine Sisters played our record. Just like with Hank Ballard and the Twist. It was a hit in the black on the black stations, but if it wasn't for Chubby Checker, it would not have been a national hit or worldwide.
And in that case, that's obviously not a white-black thing. It was more that it had Dick Clark behind it.
Well,
Chubby.
Not only Dick Clark, it was a lot of disc jockeys. It was kind of hectic, but the disc jockeys in those days, you were at their mercy.
Very competitive.
You were at their mercy. You know, it was payola. If you don't pay, they don't play. With this Hearts Made of Stone, it just took off so well. And that boosted the sales of the Charms. But the Fontaine Sisters got the most monetary play.
Now, did Sid buy the rights to Hearts Made of Stone? Or
I don't know.
Because he was known for buying the publishing for...
I don't know. He's snicking up to do that. Yeah. You know, I mean... He did all that stuff, didn't he, Paul?
He and the A&R man.
Yeah, and Henry Glover.
Yeah, they would all have their names on it.
Yeah.
They would write us.
I mean, I would write a song, and he'd say, well, like, why don't you put some of the other guys' names on there? And I'd look down, and it would be him and Henry Stone. And Sid would be on one, Stone would be on one. And Sid had another name that he used on...
So it was Henry Stone, Henry Glover's... name?
No, Henry Stone was actually my first A&R man.
Oh, okay.
But by the time we got to Hearts Made of Stone, they pushed us into Henry Glover, who was like the number two man at King Records at the time, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was.
Sid thought that he could do more with us than Stone. Then he bought the contract. I think we actually signed with Stone. Sid took the contract. Well, I didn't take it from him, but I guess he bought the contract from Stone, our contract. And that set us on our way. You know, he bought us a car, bought us some clothes, gave us some money and said, go. And we went out and did record hops after record. I mean, 1,000 record hops, thousands of kids. And everybody was playing it all over the country.
And what year was it?
54. That was the first one. And
So tell us what a King recording session might be like.
18, 20 hours.
That's right.
Paul and I remember sitting up in that place. I mean, you ate there, you slept there, you worked there. It was rare that you got out of there. And you could attest to that.
That's why Juanita was there. It was the only way to see your husband,
wife,
I guess.
I'd like to inject something. The only thing, when I worked with Bradshaw, we would play all these tunes that we were going to record out on the road. And we had audience approval. We would play them all over the country. We knew they were good. So mm-hmm. we'd come into the studio, mm-hmm. and we could cut a whole album in a day.
Well, there's a real, I mean, we should really talk about some of the difference between what Otis Williams does and what Philip Paul was doing with Tiny Bradshaw, because Tiny was kind of almost out of the big band era, but because sort of that the smaller groups that came up after World War II, they didn't, you know, you didn't have a huge band. Plus, there were usually a little better amplification system, so you can get by with a smaller combo. But he was kind of a little big band.
That's right.
In what he did.
And we had seasoned musicians. We had good musicians.
Yeah.
Always had. Tiny's had one of the best bands out on the road, really.
Right.
And today, Tiny's, of course, known for Train Kept a Rollin', which became a huge rock and roll hit. It's been recorded every decade and become a hit in every decade since he did it.
He was known not only for good vocals, but good instrumentals.
Whoa, bop today.
Oh, what a girl.
Oh, bop today.
Oh, what a girl.
Boo-dow.
Boo-dow.
Boo-day.
Boo-day.
Bop today.
Oh, what a girl.
I hopped the train. I met a real dame. She was a hipster and a gone dame. She was pretty from New York City. And she trucked on down the old fair lane with a heave and ho. And I just couldn't let her go. So get along, sweet little woman, get along. Better be on your way, get along. Sweet little woman, get along. Better be on your way with a heave and a ho. And I just couldn't let her go. Yes, the train kept rolling
all night long.
Yeah, the train kept rolling
all night long. Jack, I couldn't let her go. Get along, sweet little woman, get along. Better be on your way, get along. Sweet little woman, get along. Better be on your way with a heave and a ho. And I sure couldn't let her go. Yeah, the train kept rolling all night long.
Oh, the train kept rolling
all night long.
Woo! Train kept rolling
all night long.
When I joined the band, they wanted to change the direction. Instead of having that rough sound, they wanted a smoother sound. So I did a whole album with just brushes.
Yeah. Mm.
They were called Soft, you know, Ping Pong, names of that type. But we had the trouble with this so-called doo-wop groups, sand groups, because as Otis said, they would come in, they had no training or anything, and we would have to just sit there and wait until they got their act together.
Right.
And still go over it 20 times.
Now, Otis is a hometown guy, but you were born in New York and raised there. And you were a jazz player on 52nd Street, right?
That's
when you were picked up by Tiny.
Yeah, I worked all over New York, Hickory House, all the clubs in the Village. And I met Tiny at the Savoy Ballroom. I was working with Buddy Johnson at the time, and He asked me to join his band. He said, I'll call you 6 months from now. And I had no intention to come to Cincinnati, but he called me, and at that time I wasn't working like most of us. And and I came down here and joined the band at the Cotton Club and started recording at King.
And they had a residency at the Cotton Club, right? They were almost like a house band there.
That's right. We had a residency for maybe 6 weeks. Then we'd go out on the road for 6 months and come back and play the Cotton Club. We were always working. Yeah. I've been very fortunate in my life. I've always been able to work. So
That shows how good you are, Paul.
I don't know. Even in Cincinnati, I complain about the environment here, but I've been able to work. I haven't had a day off in 5 years.
That's right. And right now, your regular gig, you've got Saturday nights at the Cincinnati downtown.
But I've been very fortunate. But it's been rough. It's been rough, really.
So when you first came to King, what was your impression of like Sid Nathan? And I mean, was that the first time you'd ever recorded? Was with Tiny?
No, I recorded in New York at Decca, Buddy Johnson, and small groups.
And those are, I mean, Buddy Johnson is I think in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame as an early early influence in the R&B Hall of Fame. It was one of those groups that really paved the way for rock and roll.
Oh yeah, he had two good singers. He had
Ella,
and Price Rock, very good. But my impression of Sid Nathan, I say Sid Nathan was one of the blackest white men I've ever seen in my life.
He really was.
Yeah, because he'd be up in your face. You know, he'd tell you exactly. He didn't know what he was talking about, but somehow
he would get his point over
with his attitude. He frightened a lot of people, and eventually. You did
he was an odd-looking man, too, I think.
Very, one of the things. With a bad breath and the whole thing.
Cigars and onions.
Cigars and onions and garlic.
But I guess he knew he didn't intimidate me, and he treated me very well, you know, because I'm kind of laid back. Really, nothing really bothers me. He treated me well.
Me, too. He kind of liked me for some reason. Yeah. But he'd jump on guys. You'd see him come in that studio and, stop it right now. Stop. Cut that off. Get out of there. And he's hollering. The man never talked low. He's screaming at everybody all the time. It's just, you know, you sit there and you want to just grab him by his face or something. You know what I mean? But he never gave me that problem.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're the same kind of guy, Otis. You laid back and you're serious looking. You look like you are. You know, there's certain people that can be intimidated. Yeah. Certain people that can't.
Right.
I remember when James Brown first came to King Records. He and the guys were out in the hall singing Please, Please, Please.
Yeah.
And Sid Nathan said, what is that they're doing? You know, we know the story of that.
But it's kind of like it seemed like every time Sid didn't like something, you should record it and put it out on the street right away.
That's right. Most things he didn't like.
He was country oriented. You have to give him that. He was country oriented. It was a country label. But
I don't think that was his personal fondness for that. I think that was what he was able to get at because of all the Midwestern Hayride players he was able to do, and he saw that audience. But I think early on then he realized that there was not that much difference between the black and white audience.
He had an idea. I'm thinking that he had an idea that there was something else to be done, and it hadn't been explored.
Because it was that kind of new world after World War II. Things had really changed.
And he saw that, you know. And like I said, he was brilliant in a way without knowing what he was brilliant in. You know what I mean? He knew that the business end of it. But he had no conception of what was happening in that studio. You know, he just throws stuff at people. I'd walk in there and there would be 10 songs I'd never seen, never heard of. And then he'd sit there and listen to those. And I listened to what he had. You know, naturally most of them were just trash. You know, then he started getting good writers out of New York to come down here and write for us and other artists, you know. And we didn't have a lot of freedom. Sid was saying, you go right, and that's the way you went. We, as a group, had no idea what we were doing, you know what I mean?
So you were a bunch of kids.
But yeah, we were just in there and just glad to be recording. And whatever he said, we did. And he'd tell you what notes not to sing, like he knew, you know what I mean? He knew nothing. Don't sing that note. And he wants you to sing the right notes that he wanted you to sing. You try to put a little flavor, a little meat in there. That wasn't allowed for my group. But he didn't let that go with the Five Rolls, the Midnighters, other groups. But he had something else in mind for us.
That's your mistake. had to run around. That's a mistake to blame me for it now. I found somebody now, as sweet as can be, and they don't do
that to me.
That's a mistake to mistreat me so. In the cold and you have no one. That's your mistake to think I was your fool. That's your mistake to break this love is rule. I found somebody now, sweet as can be, and they don't do that to me.
Was he trying to get you into a smoother pop kind of sound?
Yeah. Well, like I said, in order to flow over into the white market, he had to find somebody that could get that airplay.
Like Nat King Cole was king back then. It was that smooth delivery. He was first African-American with his own network TV show,
pretty,
et cetera.
Pretty
I mean,
much.
He kind of led that crossover.
Right. He led the crossover with, and it came on that Hearts Made of Stone. That was the first song of the crossover. And that's what he was looking for. And I think he just stumbled into it from the King Records side. We got the airplay because of the Fontaine sisters. Hadn't been for them, we wouldn't have gotten it. It would have taken a little more time. It would have happened eventually. But at that time, there was no black artists being played on pop stations. There was pop stations, and that was pop. That was it. And you put black people on that station would be like Al Hibbler.
Billy Eckstein, maybe.
Billy Eckstein, the Ink Spots.
Nat Cole, of course.
Nat Cole, naturally. But that was what we considered pop. That was black pop. So there was nothing between the pop and the blues. But I think we both, Paul and I, are pretty much in agreement as to how that thing went, you know, how the flow came about, because we saw it. Right, we were part of it. Paul did 80% of my records. He played on 80% of my stuff.
Pretty much 80% of everything that came out of King back then.
Yeah.
And Sid Nathan, I remember one day, I was playing something out of it, and I wasn't doing what he wanted. He came down and grabbed the drumsticks out of my hand.
Yeah.
I looked at him like he was crazy. Yeah. Grabbing my drumsticks. I got up off the drums. I just walked away.
Yeah.
And I let him sit down. In other words, I was telling him, okay, let me see what you want to do.
Yeah.
You know, he pulled out. He said, that's what I want. I said, okay, man, give me the sticks. And I sat down and did this very same thing
you
were doing before.
Yeah.
He said, that's
it. That's what I want. That's it.
So, you know, that gave me an insight into what this man was about.
He's trying to, he was
played him like he played me.
Intimidation. He just tried to intimidate Paul. Yeah. Paul didn't go for it. Yeah. You know?
I think we've all had bosses like that at one time or another.
This guy was strong as ink, man. He'd say he'd spend the money. And we'd go to these distributors out of town and do record hops and do parades. But he would not give the disc jockeys any money to play our records. Ours. Now, I can't say what he did with other people. But he wouldn't pay anybody. And I think what it was, he saw we had a hit. And there were none out there. You know what I'm saying? He was on the front page. So he'd say, play my record. You don't want to play my record? That's okay. The guy down the street's going to play my record.
And he'll get the listeners.
Yeah,
that's
so,
right.
So that's where, you know, so he didn't have to pay. And then later on, the payola came. Now, I don't know how much Sid paid, but Sid was
he kept records, and he reported that on his income taxes, business expenses.
He did?
So, yeah, when the Paola trials were coming about, he wasn't doing anything illegal. He was just paying to get his records played.
Yeah.
The disc jockeys accepted it, and they didn't report it on their taxes. That's their business. But he kept business records, and he took them as tax deductions, business expenses.
Yeah. On the front end, he didn't pay anybody. He didn't think he had to. But our records would stay on the chart 4 and 5 months. We stayed out on the road with Hearts Made of Stone for 2 years.
But now, did you see any money out of King Records with these
hit
records?
No, you don't see any money. King Records, no way. By the time he gets through inflating your session cost, you owe him.
Was he charging you for those valet expenses and all? Did he charge
you
on the road and all?
I'll tell you how cheap Sid was. My mother was getting married. Sid said, I'll take care of everything. You know, everything, anytime he had a problem with me or wanted me to come in, he'd always call my mother.
Right, she's the one who got you in the label at the first place.
Well, she was getting married. So Sid said, well, I'll take care of the wedding. I'll take care of everything. He went and bought her a set of silverware. Had that at the wedding. He was at the wedding. Naturally, a lot of the entertainers were. And so at the end of the wedding, well, the next day, I go in and I said, Sid, I really appreciate everything, man. I think you're really a heck of a guy to do that for my mom. You know, he said, oh, no problem, Otis, no problem. You know, anything I can do to help, man, you know, I really love your mom. And so my next statement, 2 or 3 months later, everything that he paid for at that wedding, I had to pay.
Including the silverware.
Every silverware, too, came out of my money. He paid for just about everything, but it came out of my money. You know?
Well, I'm going to say something nice about Sid.
Okay, all right.
During the session one day, he got angry at me or something. He said, I want you to go to the conservatory. I said, fine. That's fine with me. I said, you going to pay for it? He said, I'll pay for everything. So he called up the conservatory and got me a teacher over there, Edward Webo, I think his name. He was a timpanist with the Cincinnati Symphony.
Mm.
I studied with him for about 2 years. You know what happened? Every time I'd go over there for a lesson, Ed Webo would say, sit down. What did you play on the job last night? Let me hear how you did do this, do that, do this. He was bleeding me. He was trying.
Learning from
you.
I'm
not saying I didn't learn anything from him, but most of the lessons that I took from him, he was bleeding me.
You were doing the teaching.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. So I went back and told Sid. He said, that's all right. That's all right. Show me what he taught you. I did a little something different. He said, that's great. That's great.
Now you had
2 years.
You had a very different relationship with Sid, though, because like you did, you know, you weren't an artist per se. You were the session guy, and you were the session guy. How did you evolve from being with Tiny to being the session drummer?
Well, they called me for a session one day with some group from Argentina, and we had to record like 2 o'clock in the morning.
What kind of music did they do?
They did Latin music, you know. They played and played what they had played on the job that night. They were working in Cincinnati somewhere.
But was it like a dance music, or was it like Latin jazz?
Latin jazz, yeah. I was able to do that. So Sid said, I like what you did with that. You know, would you play with this group tomorrow, with that group next week? I said, fine. So even though they changed A&R, man, they all liked me and they liked what I was doing, so they would recommend me for a session.
And Sid actually helped you buy a house about a quarter mile away from the studio.
Present house that my wife is living. That's why I live in Evanston now.
Yeah.
Because it's about 2-3 blocks from the studio, and I would walk. They would call me at 7:30 in the morning and come to the session.
And you just left your drums set up at the studio?
Yeah, that old beat-up set of drums. I was responsible for the drums over there. He was so cheap, he wouldn't buy drum heads. He wouldn't buy anything.
He was cheap.
He never spent a penny. He didn't have to.
When we first started, we only had 6 tracks. Minoral. That's what we recorded with for the first 2 years. There was no stereo.
Did he have a tape machine back then, or was it a wire recorder? So
no, it was a board. Yeah, it was in. He had a regular board, but it was only 6 tracks, and it was minoral. That's what we started with. If you listen to some of that old stuff, you hear the guitar, twing, you hear all that stuff, but all that stuff is original. It's still on the original recordings. He couldn't get it all out. I mean, they tried to bleed it out and all that stuff, but it never got all that stuff out. I mean, you'd be surprised how many records early on you hear people talking at the end of a song. You know what I mean? You hear all that stuff, and this all that stuff is original. And people like that, the original sound of all that, because it's like them sitting in right there with you.
Right, it was
so hearing the mistakes, and it was a lot of mistakes made. So if the guitar player said, dwing, okay, then you had to go back and do the whole thing again. Because of the fact you only had what you had, or was the drums and bass on the same mic, and then you had the voices on one mic, the lead singer was on one mic, but then you had the piano and drums or something on another mic. You didn't have that many tracks, you know, to work with, so he doubled up everything.
And this is the kind of thing, I mean, if you know how recordings are done today, which is, you know, endless digital tracks.
Yeah.
And everything is done and overdubbed and right. Everything is recorded separately, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, this is everybody on the floor, everybody doing this from the singer to the drummer, everybody's playing through the.
When we were there, in our day, everybody was there doing it live.
And you know what? I did, way back, I did hundreds of overdubs.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, right. Would call me and say, I got you some overdub. And I put on the headphones, I'd listen. And I'd have to upbeat the drum beat that was originally on the track.
Oh, okay.
Right.
Now, were those things that were cut at King, or were those outside records that he
bought? Some of them were outside, and I don't know, Sid was a pirate. You don't know where
he was. Yeah,
yeah, right.
Well,
that was pretty much, that's the record business, too. He wasn't alone in that, you know.
That's right.
But, Sid used everything he had. I mean, anything he could think of to cut a corner or to save a dime.
Yeah. Now he was big on cover songs. Like he would hear about another record that was starting to break from his distributors, and because of the way he'd set up King, he was able to rush a group in there, cover that tune, and get it out within a day or so. Because King was unique in that it had everything under one roof. It had the offices, it had the studio, it had the mastering facilities, it had the pressing plant, it had a printing plant. You could go in there and come out the next day with a finished record.
Complete.
And that's how you beat the guys with, you know, good distributorship. You could get it out to your distributors.
Right.
So instead of the record that was starting to be a hit, you undercut them, which made Sid very unpopular in the, in the record business.
Hey, it's fingers, up in time. Fingers, up in time. I feel so good, and that's a real good sign. Here comes a Mary, here comes Sue, here comes Johnny and a Bobby too. It's finger, pop in time. I feel so good, and that's a real good sign. Hey now, hey now, hey now, hey now, hey baby, come along with me. Hey, baby, come along with me. We're gonna shake it till it breaks. Just to wait and see. Here comes a Mary, here comes Sue, here comes Johnny and a Bobby too. It's finger, pop in time. I feel so good, and that's a real good sign. Here comes a Mary, here comes Sue, here comes Johnny and a Bobby too. It's a finger, pop in time. I feel so good, that's a real good sign. Hey now.
Now one of those early guys was actually a King artist, a guy named Boy Bennett. White guy, sort of like a Bill Haley, even maybe a little earlier than Haley.
Yeah.
And he covered R&B stuff and blues and all for that pop audience. Did you guys know Boyd at all?
I think I worked with him on a show in Detroit. But what they did, they would try to, because of the white and black thing, the white artists would jump on the black artists. They could get the sales. They could get the airplay faster than the black artists could get it. So they would jump on it as soon as it came out, if it sounded like it was a good song, especially if there was an artist like the Charms, that had hit records. they jump right on it because they know the record's going to sell so many automatically. So if you're selling records, somebody's going to jump on you. And that's what happened. Everything we hit, we had about 9 hits and 2 gold.
And they would record them in that kind of a blander sort of, they'd even out the funkier edges of it.
Well, they couldn't do
and
it the other way.
They had a bigger record label?
They couldn't do it. They couldn't get our sound. Mm-hmm. You see what I mean? So it was still a pop sound, but because there was no funk in it, and there's no drive and no push, and no white singers would sing straight.
Right.
You know, and black singers would sing with a little flavor. You know, so they couldn't get that flavor, so it wind up being pretty much bland. But it would sell because it was a hit record by the black artist. They would sell more because they had a wider audience.
Right. And would it be a larger label than recording them as well? Would that help?
Yeah. But in those days, there weren't that many big labels.
Yeah.
She got real crazy legs. You upset me, baby.
Upset me, baby.
You upset me, baby.
Upset me, baby.
Telling you people she's something you ought to see. Well, she's not too tall. Complexion is fair. Man, she knocks me out the way she wears her hair. You upset me, baby.
Upset me, baby.
You upset me, baby.
Upset me, baby.
Like being hit by a tree. Woman, what you doing to me? Well, I try to describe her, it's hard to start. I better stop now, cause I got a weak heart. You upset me, baby.
You upset me, baby.
You upset me, baby.
You upset me, baby.
Like being hit by a tree. Woman, what you doing to me? She got real crazy like you upset me, baby.
You upset me, baby.
You upset me, baby.
You upset me, baby.
I'm telling you, bitch, something you ought to see. Well, she's not too tall, complexion is fair. Man, she knocks me out the way she wears her hair. You upset me, baby.
You upset me, baby.
Yeah, you upset me, baby.
You upset me, baby.
Like being hit by a tree. Woman, what you doing to me? Scriber, it's hard to start. I better stop now, cause I got a weak heart. You upset me, baby.
You upset me, baby.
You upset me, baby.
You upset me, baby.
Like being hit by a tree. Woman, what you done to me?
You upset me, baby.
We got on the road, we didn't know what to do. There was nothing for us to go by. You know, and then we start doing stuff like choreography. Mm-hmm. And everybody did the arm pump, or they did skits mm-hmm. on stage. And then we watched.
Hank Ballard was big on that kind of thing with the skits, I guess. And
Hank didn't move 2 feet. You know, Hank didn't move very much, but his groups, he always had good groups, guys that could move. When he got older and those guys had dissipated, then he would get younger guys like Jimmy. And those guys would do all the stepping. They'd be flying all over the place. Like I do the same thing now with mm-hmm. my guys.
So with all those hit records and the gold records and all, I guess you're a very rich man now.
I wish. I wish. I quit in 60. When I went to service, I gave it up. I almost had a nervous breakdown, and when I was 21, I was doing all the singing, choreography, writing, arranging, and handling all the business. For a kid, that's a lot. You know, we didn't know. I was bugging everybody, and they called me a pest because I watched everything. I watched everybody, how to dress, how to do the interviews with the disc jockeys, and how to conduct yourself. There was no formal training, you know, so.
And coming from an athletic background, you were used to training, you were used to discipline.
Yeah, so it didn't bother me. I was okay with that. I knew I had to pay my dues. They just called me. I was out there with Joe Turner, Faye Adams.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? Right. These people. And these were all blues artists. I mean, Joe would stand in one place and just stand and roll his hand around, and the whole place would erupt. Because we had to play for white artists one night, and the next night we'd do it for black artists. Or if it was in the same venue the same night, I mean, and we had to do two nights. One night, it was a concert for white.
And this is in the South or in the North
as
well?
Yeah, in the South. It was in the South.
In Indiana.
It might have been. You know, we had most of our problems in the South. Texas, believe it or not, Arizona. The Indians in Arizona could go to the movie theater. But they had to sit upstairs. So the blacks had to sit upstairs. The whites sat downstairs. That way, all through Arizona. We couldn't understand all this, coming from Cincinnati.
Right.
Which we only lived in a small area. Cincinnati was a small area for us. We had East End, West End, Warren Hills, and Avondale.
And, of course, King Records, for all its whatever else, was a fairly integrated business, was part of the thing.
Yeah, it got that way, mm-hmm. You know, because he started picking up different artists, but he'd drop them if they didn't like the platters. He had the platters. And they did Only You, and I heard that original record recording, and it was terrible.
Only you can make this world seem right.
Then they went to Atlantic someplace and did the same song, Only You, and it hit.
Better recording, better production, was it? Or
I think so. You know, Sid didn't spend a lot of money, you know, on equipment and stuff. He had the entertainers and the musicians. He had the best, you know, musicians in the world. I mean, I get guys all the time, Curtis Pegler, Ray Felder, Paul, jazz musicians. Because they could play. You know, they had played and played with flavor. And, you know, you never had to worry about them. They were there. They were rock solid. You know, then that Muscle Shoals thing came up. And, you know, all that stuff just evolved. Everything evolved off of
right.
King Records,
yeah.
Really.
Yeah, that's the whole house band thing. I mean, and, you know, when we talk about King, and we're talking today about that kind of rhythm and blues into the soul era, but King was so many different labels. I mean, my story about King is, you know, I grew up in New York. And I kind of was familiar with King, just, you know, I knew the James Brown hits and that sort of thing. I came to Cincinnati Actually, I came to Cincinnati to play with Katie Lauer's bluegrass band about 30, almost 30 years ago. And King had great bluegrass records.
Yeah.
And but I didn't know it was the same label. And my girlfriend, who was my first wife, had James Brown records. And I would see these Stanley Brothers records. Now, if you've ever heard the Stanley Brothers, there's no more bluegrass that sounds more mountainy and old than the Stanley Brothers. It sounds like they're recording on rocks instead of tape. I mean, it's ancient sounding. So you got the Stanley Brothers and you got James Brown. And I thought, well, isn't that an amazing coincidence that two record labels that are so different have the exact same name? How can that be?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I didn't realize at that time, this was back probably 1971 or so, that King... that they were not only in the same building, they were in the same studio. I mean, it's just, right. It's amazing. The range of stuff that was recorded on King. If you're a bluegrass fan, you know King because of the Stanley Brothers, Reno and Smiley, Charlie Moore and Bill Napier. If you're a country fan, you know King because of Hawkshaw Hawkins and all those other artists.
Right.
If you're a jazz fan, you know the Earl Bostic stuff, the Hank Morris stuff,
right.
Bill Doggett and Honky mm-hmm. Tonk. I mean, every guitar player in the 50s kind of learned how to playing along with Billy Butler on Honky Tonk.
Yeah.
You know, right. And then, you know, you go on with the Freddie King stuff. I mean, Freddie King is probably the most influential blues guitarist for that whole British invasion. There wouldn't be an Eric Clapton without Freddie King. There wouldn't be a Jimmy Page without Freddie King. And all that stuff happened in Cincinnati.
Yeah.
Now, the question is how many listeners out there know this? How many people in Cincinnati even know what King did?
Very few. We got very little notoriety here in this city. We recorded here. But in order to get a name or a further you had to get out of here.
And it was kind of a white-black thing because the black community knew what King was doing. There were a lot of people working there and people who knew the label.
There are a lot of black people that are not aware of
King. Right. Yeah, I was going to say that. They were not aware.
They had to be
musicians or, mm-hmm. you know, they're, entertainers.
There are people in my neighborhood. I live in Evanston. They're not aware of the history of King Records.
Right. They have no idea. And that's because... you know, Sid did his own thing, and that was it. I mean, when we went into recording, like Paul and the rest of the musicians were primarily here. They worked outside of King Records, naturally, to make a living. I mean, you had a lot of artists coming in here working Babe Bakers.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Name acts that play Birdland every day. You know what I mean? All these artists would come in here. And we'd use some of them sometimes, like...
Johnny Griffin recorded at King.
Yeah.
Great sax player.
Yeah. I recorded with him.
Yeah, there's a story about... I mean, him just doing sessions and stuff. He came in, and he's a tenor player, of course, but he came in and Sid used him on baritone sax. Now, Johnny Griffin's one of the great jazz horn players, but Sid didn't know who the guy was. So the story goes that, you know, after the session, he says, who is that guy on baritone? Take his name down. I think we can use him again.
Yeah.
So you can hear that.
It was great. It was a great time. You know, mm-hmm. we didn't realize it at the time, and we didn't think today this would be happening today that you'd even, because it was unheard of. You were just an entertainer. You're not thinking about tomorrow or next year.
Mm-hmm.
There were no labels on anything. You just got in there and did what you did.
And you were so young, you didn't worry about having
paying
for a house or kids or whatever.
We never thought about doo-wop or R&B. It evolved to R&B quickly. The name came up very quickly.
It was coined in like 1949, Jerry Wexler, when he was with Billboard. You know, it was race music or whatever.
It was race music. That's what they called it. Because the only reason it was called race music, because it wasn't black people that called it race music.
Right.
You see what I'm saying? So that was the reason it was called race music, because it was white people, DJs primarily, calling it race music. And the parents didn't want to hear it, you know, from the kids. So they called it anything to put it down. So the kids wouldn't do it, wouldn't dance to it, or wouldn't buy it.
Of course, you tell your kids not to do something, and they're go for it.
And then
right away.
They go. They're going all the way.
That's right.
But it was good music, and they enjoyed it.
Crazy, crazy, crazy love. Crazy, crazy, crazy love. When I hold my baby tight, we cannot say goodnight. Crazy, crazy, crazy love. She should, and I would if I could make some crazy, crazy love. Yes, I know that she is willing, and it will be so thrilling. Oh, lips of warm and tender, one more kiss and she'll surrender. Crazy, crazy, crazy love.
This has been part two of a four-part series about King Records. Next week, you'll hear from other members of the roundtable discussion, including the Charms and musician Keith Little. Wardell Fallon, a member of the Famous Flames, will also share his memories of King. King Records, Cincinnati Legacy, was produced in the studios of 91.7 WBXU. Technical assistance from Darren Blaze and Shake It Records. I'm Lee Hay.